Morning. Good to see everyone again. We are in Psalm 63, and if you remember, we started a series last week on worship. I was looking up some different kind of statistics on where we are right now in terms of worship, and according to the Pew Research Group, which put out some findings about 2022. These are the numbers that they came up with when it comes to religion and worship. They said there's approximately 330 million people in the United States. The estimate is that 10 to 15% are atheists or agnostics. 30% consider themselves religious but have no religious affiliation. And on any given Sunday, about 30% of our population goes to church or to synagogue on Sunday. What they noted was that the 30% is actually down from 5 years ago, so we still haven't gotten back to kind of pre-pandemic numbers. But what they've seen overall is this decline, that less and less people are going to church. They also did a breakout by state, because I know all of you are interested in that, and the lowest states in terms of church attendance. The two that are lowest are Oregon and Washington, and those are probably the two most progressive states in the country. The third least attended is Alaska, and that's, you know, obviously because it's freezing cold. I mean, you can't go every week. One after that is Nevada, and we kind of know why people don't go to church there, right? That's a different thing. And then West Virginia, and that one I'm not really sure, like, what's happening there. But basically, the picture that this research group gives is that, and this is the same across like a lot of other polling groups that are looking at this issue of spirituality, is that the vast majority of people in the country are not very interested in God or religion or church. And, you know, for a lot of us, that's not a shocking development. In fact, that's one of those things that most of us know from just our experience. In the places that we live, we look around at our neighbors, we look at our coworkers, we look at, people that we know, and a lot of them don't go to church. I don't know if it's more than 30%, less than 30%, but even in our families, we have family members that aren't believers that we're praying for. And so, I mean, even from just our personal experience, it's not surprising to hear that most people, the vast majority of people, aren't very interested in God or religion or church. Now, I'm going to say something surprising, and basically this is kind of what we're going to be talking about today. The surprising thing is, though, even though people aren't interested in God, even though they're not very interested in religion, even though they don't take church very seriously, even though all those things aren't important to people, worship is. I know that's shocking to say, right? Only 30% on a Sunday go to church, but worship is important for everyone. Whether they realize it or not. And that's actually what Psalm 63 kind of points out. What we have in front of us is we have this psalm, and it's a psalm of David. This is when David is king. This is towards the end of his life. And basically, as he's ruled over the kingdom of Israel for a long period of time, they've experienced prosperity. They've experienced peace, even though they've had moments of war and times of conflict. And here towards the end of his life, we have this event. The psalm tells us that it's written when he's in the wilderness of Judah. And what's happening at this point in his life is his son has grown up and seized the kingdom. His son Absalom has kind of made these deals with people within David's kingdom, these other officials. And essentially, he's stolen the throne and the kingdom from David. And so David, just to save his life, has to run away. He escapes into this, they call it the wilderness of Judah, but it's basically a desert. And it's in this desert that he reflects. What we see in the first part of this reflection is we see him deal with this issue of worship, right? He kind of wrestles with God and he deals with this issue of worship. And so that's really what we're going to be looking at today. We're going to be concentrating on the first four verses. And essentially, we're going to see three things. We're going to see first the truth about worship. Second, we're going to see the danger of worship. And third, we're going to see the power in worship. So first, the truth about worship. Second, the danger of worship. And third, the power in worship. So first, the truth about worship. Again, if you go to verses 1 and 2, we see that clearly. David's in the wilderness, and he says this. He says, "O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. So I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory." Now, as I mentioned, the psalm was written at a very, very difficult time in David's life. He's not only lost the throne, he's not only lost his kingship, but he's been betrayed by family, right? By his own flesh and blood, by his own son. His own son has kind of risen up and through these deals and this back alley dealing has kind of stolen the kingship from him. And in a very interesting way, just like David, it's in difficult situations, it's in difficult times that we recognize how important God is, that we look for God's help. It's in those situations that we realize how much we need him, how much help we need from him, how much we need worship. In verse 1, we hear David's anguish, right? He says, "Oh God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you." Right? We see this need. What's interesting is in verse 2, it's still need, but it shifts. In verse 2, he says, "So I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory." And what's happening here is he's not just longing for God. In verse 2, he misses the worship of God. He's thinking back to being back in Jerusalem. He thinks back to living in the palace and going out to God's sanctuary. The temple hasn't been built yet. But he remembers going there, and he remembers worship. He remembers celebration. He remembers the singing. He remembers the priests. He remembers the people. He remembers the worship. And so he doesn't just miss God in terms of, "God, I long for you." He also longs for worship. And you know, it points us to this truth, right? It points us to this truth that not only David, but you and I, that all of us were created to worship and that we need to worship. You know, for David, he longed not just for God, but for worship. And that sounds like a really strange thing to say that we need worship, because you know what? The honest truth is, Sunday worship is one of the easiest things to miss, right? Like you sit at home and, you know, you get up in the morning and you're tired on Sunday and, you know, you kind of think about church, and it's really easy to say, "You know what? I'm just going to stay home today." All right? My guess is that thought ran through a lot of your heads this morning. You're at home, it's kind of crummy outside, and you go, "It'd just be so much easier just to stay at home." Right? It seems silly to say that we need worship, but I mean, that's what we see here. David says, "God, I need you," but then he also says, "And I look and I remember I need worship." You know, and what's interesting is the Bible teaches us that you and I, we're people who were created to worship. Right, just like birds were meant to fly, just as fish were meant to swim, we were created, we were built, we were designed to worship from the very beginning. And we actually see that in Genesis. If you go back to Genesis and you begin to read through, the Bible makes it very clear that we are created to worship. Right? You go into chapter 4, and this is before God has commanded anyone to worship, before he's given any regulations about worship, before he said anything about any type of instructions on what worship is supposed to look like. And in Genesis chapter 4, what happens? Cain and Abel worship. Right? They bring offerings to God. And you remember the story because, you know, they bring these offerings and God accepts one, but he doesn't accept the other, and it causes the spat. And so Cain kills his brother Abel. But you have to remember, like, all of this is before there's any regulations about it, right? In their hearts, they just want to worship. We see that all through the book of Genesis. If you continue on, we see time and time again, we see people worshiping. There's no regulations, no instructions, no commands, and yet people worship everywhere. For Noah, when he comes out of the ark, he builds an altar, and he worships. For Abraham builds these wells as memorials. He puts up stones as these memorials. He builds altars. He worships. You know, even for people who aren't God's people, all through Genesis, we find out they build shrines. They make offerings, right? They do all these different things. Why? Because every single one of us has this instinct. We have this desire to worship. We see that in anthropology. Anthropology tells us that every group of people everywhere from the beginning of time have worshiped. This whole thing about atheism is a relatively new thing in our culture, but historically, every tribe, every group of people, have always worshiped. And even though it's been different things, the sun, moon, stars, animals, forces of nature, spirits, I mean, the truth is that we were made to worship. We have this instinct where we need to worship. And we see that in human nature. Right? You go to a sporting event and everyone wants to jump up when something great happens. Right? We see this instinct where we want to exalt something. We want to praise something. We want to celebrate something. We want to worship something. The American novelist David Foster Wallace said this. He wasn't a Christian, but in a commencement speech, he said this. He said, basically, based on his study of human nature, his understanding of what motivates people in his writing and how to write characters, how to understand people, he said this to the class. He said, everybody worships. There's another part to that quote. I'll say that for point two, but he said, everybody worships. In his estimation, understanding people, watching how people live, watching what motivates them, he said, all of us worship. Every single one of us. We were created to worship. And you know, we see it today in people who aren't religious. There's a lot of people who don't believe in God, who don't want to believe in God, who never want to step into church, but they want to worship. And so what do? Well, they worship in nature. They go out and they see beautiful things and they worship. Right? They celebrate. They glorify. They exalt. Or they want to practice spirituality and worship through exercise. They breathe in and they breathe out and they want it to be more than just the physical manifestations of the body. They want it to be worship. For others, they eat a good meal and they say, this is life. What is it? That's worship. Right? Or they sit down with friends and they want it to be a spiritual experience. See, for every single one of us, we were created to, and we have an instinct to worship. Right? Just as birds were made to fly, just as fish were made to swim, we were made to worship. And that's why for David, when all the chips are down, he doesn't just say, God, I need you. He says, I need to worship. He says, I remember the sanctuary. I remember the people. I remember the songs and the singing. I remember the music. I remember the worship. I remember you. Right? We were created to worship. I mean, that's the truth. Worship isn't just a Christian thing. It's a human thing. We're created to worship. We need to worship. So that's the first thing we see. Second thing we see is we see the danger of worship. Go to verse 2 again. And in verse 2, again, this is where it becomes more specific about worship. He says, so I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory. If you remember verse 1, David longs for God. He's far away from home. He's far away from people. And so what he does is he begins to worship. And the way that he does it is he looks upon God. He remembers and he beholds God's power and God's glory. We said this last week, and I'm going to say it a lot more times throughout the year, but if you remember what worship is, worship comes from this English phrase, this English word, worthship. And the idea is what worthship is to ascribe worth to something, to look at something and say, you are valuable, you are worthwhile. What worship is worship is a little bit more than that, though. It's to look at something, to proclaim it to be ultimate worth. Ultimate value, to say this is the thing that matters the most. And essentially what David is doing in his worship is what worship looks like in our hearts. It's to take something and to gaze at it, and to behold it, to see its power and to see its glory. And you know, one of the dangers is that can be God or that can be something else. Now, this is the biggest question of worship. The biggest question of worship is not, do you worship? Right? That's not the big question, because we've answered that in point one. The question, do you worship? The answer is always yes. All of us worship. Every single one of us worships. We were built, designed, created to worship. We have an instinct to worship. The question isn't, do you worship? The question is, who or what do you worship? Because every single one of us takes something and we place it at the very center of our lives. We take something and we say, this is the most important thing, the most valuable thing. This is the thing that has the most power, the most glory in this life, in this world. And whatever that is, that will drive your life. You know, the author that I mentioned, David Foster Wallace, the second half of his quote, he says, he not only says, everyone worships, he says, whatever we worship, that's what controls us. And as a writer who writes about people and about motivations and why people do the things they do, he has it exactly right. He got it exactly right. You see, the danger of worship is whatever we gaze at, whatever we look at the most, whatever we ascribe power and glory to, whatever that thing is, it will control us. If it's God, good. If it's not, then it will destroy us. Through controlling us, it will destroy us. So for instance, I remember a long time ago, this was back when they did the original show, but there was a animated show called DuckTales. I don't know if you guys remember that. I used to come home, I used to watch it all the time. And I remember there was, for some reason I remember this, I don't remember a lot about it. It was like Scrooge McDuck and his nephews, and they would go on these adventures. It was kind of like Indiana Jones type of thing for kids, where they would go to these different parts of the world, this animated world, and they look for treasure, they would deal with mysteries. And I remember this one episode, I don't know what the episode was about, but Scrooge McDuck was sleeping in his bed and he was snoring. His nephews run in really quietly and they notice that he's asleep. And as he's sleeping, he's snoring and he's dreaming about money. Right? He's dreaming, he's counting his money, I think. That's what he was doing. What Scrooge McDuck was doing was, the reason why he dreamt about it was because that's what he gazed at. He gazed at money. Right? That's why it filled his mind, it filled his dreams, it filled his heart. And so one of the things that you saw all throughout the series was the thing that mattered most to him was money. The thing that mattered to him was money. The way he measured people was money. The thing that helped him determine what decisions to make was money. And it made him a very selfish character. And what was great is he would come out of that and he would do things that were not about money. He would do things that are loving and kind for people, for his nephews, for other people in need. But at the heart of it, it was this idea of looking at money, looking at wealth, and saying, that is my power, that is my glory. Whatever you put at the center of your life, whatever you worship, it will ultimately control you. You know, if you put money and wealth at the center of your life, you may attain more than anyone else, but you will always live in fear of not having enough or losing what you do have. It will absolutely control you to the very end. If you take something like beauty and give it power and give it glory, it will absolutely control you. When you're young, you will love it. You will make yourself as beautiful as possible. But as you start to get old, you will fear it. It will create in you insecurities. And as you get older, as you see the lines come on your face, as you see the hair color change, it'll fill you with regret. It'll fill you with fear. It'll fill you with insecurity. Now, whatever it is that you worship, whatever it is that you gaze at, it will control you. And you see, that's what we do. We gaze at those things. We say, I must have that. If I have that, everything will be better. If I could get that, things would be so much easier. If I could be that, then that would take care of all my problems. And what it does in the beginning is it controls you in a good way. It pushes you, it drives you, it motivates you. But at the end, it ends up destroying you. Because whatever that is, if it's not God, You will spend your entire life living in fear and doubt and regret. See, the big question is, it isn't do you worship? The question is, what do you worship? Because whatever the answer is, it will either bless you or it will break you. Every single one of us worships. Every single one of us has to put something at the very core of our lives. And if it's wrong, it will break us. And one of the questions that I wanted to ask you is this. What do you gaze at? Right? What do you dream about? I remember when I was doing ministry back in Connecticut, towards the end, I started noticing that for some of the people in our ministry who were Christians, they were also singles, one of the things they gazed a lot at was they gazed at marriage. They gazed at this idea of romantic love and kind of finding someone and, you know, having a, you know, family. That's what they gazed at. That's what they dreamed about. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with wanting to get married. There's nothing wrong with wanting to have a family. There's nothing wrong with a lot of those things. But for some of the people in the church, that's what they gazed at. They said, oh, if I could have that, if I could find just the right person, if I could have just the right kind of family, that then my life would be worthwhile. Then my life would be meaningful. Then that person, you know, that would save me from loneliness, from despair, from emptiness. And for those couple who couldn't find the right person, it did throw them into despair. Right? What do you gaze at? What do you dream about? Where does your mind go when you don't have to think about anything? Whatever it is, that's what we worship. Now, it's an amazing thing how obsessive we can become. And that's this idea of worship, right? We can become obsessive about a TV show. We can become obsessive about a celebrity. We can become obsessive about an activity. For instance, you've probably seen people who are obsessed with something that seems as innocuous as Star Wars, right? New Star Wars movie comes out, and they're not just the person who wants to go. They want to go see it on the first night, and they dress up to go see it, right? There's people who dress up. There's people who live their lives by the Jedi code. And there is kind of a technical word for that, nerd, right? That's someone who, and what they're doing is this obsession is worship. They want to worship. They have an instinct to worship. They place it at the center of their lives, and the danger is it controls them. It takes over, and it becomes everything. But we were created to worship. We were created to put something in the center. Here's the good part, and here's hopefully the helpful part. This also helps us understand what true worship is. True worship is putting God into our gaze, right? Staring at Him, beholding His power, beholding His glory. True worship is pushing everything aside and making God our true obsession, our true gaze, looking at Him. When you do that, if you're able to do that, and when you do that, then God becomes your motivation. God becomes your reward, and God begins to reshape you in these powerful ways. You know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, if you're around me enough, you'll hear me say how, you know, important things like, your personal spiritual life is, your personal prayer life, studying the Bible with other people, you know, all these different things. You'll hear me kind of talk about those things, meditation. You'll hear me talk about all these things again and again, because they're ways to put God back into our gaze. They're ways, even Sunday service. Sunday service is a way to put God back into your gaze, that He's the one you're thinking about. He's the one you're staring at. He's the one you're beholding. And as you see Him, you begin to behold His power and glory all over again. That's true worship. know, true worship is when we make God our obsession, when he's all we can think about, when he fills our minds, when he overflows in our hearts, where things quiet down and our minds are still full of him. Right? What do you gaze at? What do you dream about? True worship is putting God into your gaze. Third thing that I want to address is the power in worship. You go to verses 3 and 4. after this whole thing about God, I seek you, my soul thirsts for you, I look in the sanctuary, behold your power and glory. Verse 3 and 4, he says, because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you, so I will bless you as long as I live. In your name I will lift up my hands. Like I said, true worship is verse 2, is gazing at God, making God your gaze. It's beholding his power, his glory. And what David says after this is, he says, when you gaze at God, you notice something really, really unusual. Right? Verse 3, he says, because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you. Essentially, what David is saying is this. He's looking at God. He's gazing at him. He's beholding his power and glory. But he doesn't talk about power and glory, does he? Right? He says, I behold your power and glory. But then he says, verse 3, because your steadfast love is better than life. You know, what David is saying is this. When you put your gaze on God, when you behold his power and glory, you actually notice something else. He says, what you actually notice is you notice not just the raw power of omnipotence, the raw power of might. When you set your gaze on God and you behold his power and glory, you don't just notice his holiness, the glory of his justice, you know, that he's an uncreated being. He says, when you put your gaze on God, honestly put your gaze on God and focus on him and think about him, you actually notice love. And you notice a very unique kind of love. It's a love that comes up here. He says steadfast, and we've talked about this. It's this idea of hesed love. A God who is always faithful, always true, never breaks a promise, always comes through. And what David says is this. He says, when you look at God, you don't just see power and glory, you see love. A love that is steady, unwavering, always faithful, always true, a love you do not deserve, yet one which has been given to you graciously. And you know, what David says is this. He says, when you see that love, God's power becomes even more powerful. Right? Because all of a sudden, God's power isn't just filled with strength and might, it's now filled with compassion and kindness. He says, now when you look at God, when you see that love, he becomes more glorious because not only is he holy and just, he is gracious and generous and merciful. And what David says is, when you see this other thing, it makes you want to sing and dance and shout. You know, I've said these kinds of things a lot, and I'm going to say it again. Christianity is the only religion that genuinely makes you want to sing, dance, and shout. Every other religion tells you you have to worship. Every other religion says you must worship. Christianity says, look at God and you will worship. Look at who he is. Look at what he's done. Look at the fact that he's not just powerful and glorious, and you will worship. See his love and you will dance. You know, like I said, you know, you see that in sports all the time. My son Evan and I went to a Caps hockey game this past Wednesday, and no, they didn't win, but it was still a fun experience. We actually ran into Eric, for those of you who might have seen the picture. We saw him right outside of Capital One Arena. We went inside, and what's really interesting is if you go to any sporting event, people don't just want to worship. People want to shout, they want to scream, they want to sing, they want to dance, they want to celebrate. You know, if you go to a Commanders game, you might not have a reason to, but if something good happens, you want to shout, you want to sing, you want to stand up, you want to dance, you want to clap. Right? And what David is talking about is more than a hockey game. Right? How much more if it's God? You know, now, I do need to say this. I know that most of us aren't very demonstrative, right? We don't have a lot of people who like dancing, much less dancing in church, and I'm kind of glad that's kind of a good thing. We don't have a lot, I think for some people here, even like the clapping makes you kind of uncomfortable. We don't have a lot of demonstrative people. I know there's even some people who feel a little bit uncomfortable if it gets too expressive, even just kind of singing's a little bit uncomfortable. In youth group a couple of weeks ago, some of the kids were sharing how for some of them, it's like they don't like singing. You know, they don't like singing in a karaoke bar, not that they go, but they don't like the idea of karaoke. But even in church, they feel uncomfortable singing. I completely get that. But there is a power when you do worship that makes you want to do those things, even if you're not the most demonstrable person. There's a kid in my youth group way back who, when I met him, he was in sixth grade going into junior high, and so I remember him from where he was relatively young. I think he had just come into the country, so he was struggling with English. The English that he spoke in the very beginning was very broken. He was kind of socially awkward anyway, and then the English thing made him a little bit more socially awkward. He was also kind of a shy kid naturally, and I remember for the first couple years, I remember him just kind of sitting in the back of our worship room, and he would never sing. You know, he would just kind of keep his mouth closed, and you know, the times he'd smile or, you know, things like that, and I would know he's a little bit engaged, but, you know, he never sang. As kind of the years went on, I think when he hit like the early and middle part of high school, God started doing something in his heart. And I could kind of see it in Bible study. He was a little bit more attentive. He would ask more questions. He would kind of speak out and share his thoughts as we were talking about God or talking about the Word. And sure enough, like one day, one Sunday, I don't remember exactly when it happened, but one Sunday I remember playing, remember looking over towards him, and there he was singing. And it was this incredible thing. I mean, one of the reasons why he didn't sing was he was uncomfortable. Another reason was he was bad. When he was still bad, but it was kind of a beautiful bad. You know, it was one of those things like literally everyone almost stopped when he started singing. But it was a beautiful kind of bad. True worship does have power. It is transformative. Now, again, I'm not saying that you have to be expressive. And I think for a lot of us, we're not that kind of expressive. But worship does something in the heart. Right? When you truly worship, when God is in your gaze, and you see not just his power and glory, but his love. It does something in your heart. It does have a power. And even if you don't end up singing and shouting, you want to. Even though you don't end up dancing, you want to. But that's the power that worship has. It has the power to override our comforts, to override our fears, to override our self-centeredness. You know, true worship has the power to change us if we let it. And the reason why is because, you know, what we see again is we don't just see power, we don't just see glory, we see love. We see a love that is faithful and unwavering for us. And we see that love on the cross. We see that Jesus laid down his life to love us. And in his death, we see his faithfulness, his goodness, his compassion, and his mercy. As we take communion together, let's look at that love again. Let's take a few moments, and as we get ready for communion, let's ask God to help us see in the bread and in the wine this love that David sees. This love that makes power even stronger. This love that makes God's glory even brighter. Let's pray. And Lord, just as David said, because we have seen your love through Jesus Christ, we should celebrate, we should sing, we should dance, we should rejoice, we should fall on our knees and worship. And so, Lord, we pray for you to transform us as we get ready to take communion together, that these are the visible elements, the visible signs of Jesus' love for us, that he was willing to lay his life down for us. Even while we were enemies, when Jesus came to rescue us from our sin. And so, Lord, as we do take each element, both humble us and bring us great joy in knowing that we are people who do not deserve it, yet are richly loved through the finished work of Christ. We pray this in his name. Amen. I'm going to ask if Justin can come up to help serve communion. And as we do each week, we want to invite you to come and take if you are a believer. If you are not, observe and see what this means to us. This is a meal. This is a family meal. Jesus lays this out, and essentially, you know, he means it for those who have experienced the life-changing, life-saving power of his love. We'll ask you to come through the center aisle, come up to the altar, and as you take the elements, make your way back to your seat, and we'll take each one together as a body, as a church. So in light of all that God has done, and in light of the love that we see in Jesus Christ, let's come and let's take.